Hi, and welcome to episode number 19 in the Signal Integrity Journal's Fundamentals Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Bogatin. I'm the technical editor of the Signal Integrity Journal. Today, I'm pleased to have with me Chris Kemmel, the co-founder and CTO of Menlo Micro. His company has a very cool technology they've applied to create ultra-high bandwidth switches. Join me in my conversation with Chris, where I learn about this technology and how it enables high bandwidth signal switching for use in high-speed serial links, in power distribution, and RF communications applications.
Chris, welcome to the podcast today.
Eric, thank you so much for having me. A pleasure to be here.
So I actually learned about Menlo Micro for the first time when I visited your booth at DesignCon a couple of years ago, and I was so impressed with what cool technology you have. Before we get into some of the details of the technology, I'm interested in a little bit about your background and journey and maybe a little bit about how you guys started Menlo Micro.
Sure. Well, my journey, I'm a material scientist by training, and so By that nature, I love to dig into devices, the physics behind devices, how they work, the materials behind how they work, even going down to the interfaces. And really, when you look at developing a technology, and particularly a new technology, a lot of times it's not so much about what you can do, but it's a lot of times about how do you solve problems and how do you go back and understand why something didn't work. And then take that failure analysis, the deep understanding about why it didn't work, and then take a step forward, improve on that, and figure out how to make that failure not happen. And typically when you do that, you introduce 100 other failures that you didn't conceive of, and you realize that your journey is going to take you not just the next week or the next month, but it might take you the next couple of years.
Your technology is MEMS based. Did you have experience in MEMS technology before starting up Menlo Micro?
Before Menlo Micro, yes, but my background again is in fabrication and processing, and actually I started working at the nanoscale making nanoelectronics, and then got introduced into these microscale devices, and working through my previous job at GE at GE's R&D center. That's where this switch technology was incubated. And eventually we spun out Menlo Micro after about 10 years of development at GE's R&D.
Oh, wow. And what is the basis of your little MEMS switches? How do they actually work?
Yeah, that's a great question, because when you think of a switch, you either tend to think of electromechanical switches or you tend to think of solid state switches. And these switches, they operate kind of in, let's say they have properties of both solid state switches and electromechanical switches. But the fundamental principle about how they work is you apply a voltage, that voltage creates an electrostatic charge, that electrostatic charge creates a field, and that field attracts a cantilever. And that cantilever is part of our switch. It closes the circuit, and now you've completed your circuit. You've turned on this very tiny microscale switch that's mechanical. So it's really just about mechanical attraction. And you can kind of think about it. Most people are used to the same type of force. It's the same type of force where if you take a balloon, rub that balloon against a shirt, and then you hold it up to your hair, right? That your hair will rise and get attracted to that balloon by the electric field. The same principle is here, except because this cantilever is only a micron away from this electrostatic pad. You don't actually need a lot of force. It's so close. So you don't also need thousands of volts. You just need a few tens of volts to cause this attraction. And by doing so, it's extremely low power in terms of how much power is consumed by making this switch open and close. And that's really one of the beauties of this technology is it's the power of change, the energy used to change states is extremely small because it's all done electrostatically.
And so normally the switch, the cantilever beam is open, and when you apply the voltage, the electrostatic force closes that switch. And you said it's tens of volts. So it's typically above the kind of the logic levels and the voltages used to trigger relays. How do you engineer that higher voltage? Do you have onboard boost converters?
Exactly. So we have well, let's say it's really depending on, we offer both solutions. We offer a solution where the end user can provide that high voltage, because in some instances, providing that high voltage is available in certain applications, and on board. In other applications, you're absolutely right. Logic control is going to exist down in that 3 to 5 volt range, and we provide onboard boost convert, basically an onboard chip that boosts the voltage up. And it'll do so by taking either a 3 or a 5 volt signal and step that up to the 80 or 90 volts that's needed to drive our devices.
So what is the actual, you started out in materials technology and this came from 10 years of development. What is the actual technology inside the MEMS switch that allows you to just use the tens of volts of electrostatic force to close that switch?
Yeah, so when most people think of MEMS devices, that they'll maybe they'll gravitate towards an accelerometer or some type of inertial sensor, a pressure sensor, even maybe an inkjet printhead. And immediately those technologies are born out of silicon micromachining, meaning that you're forming the base unit out of silicon. Just like just like transistors have their home. They make their home in silicon-based technology, where you're transporting holes or electrons back and forth across the channel. Well, Menlo's device, and where this unique material science comes in here, is we're a metal device. We kind of classify ourselves, we're not actually a semiconductor, even though our device is built on a semiconductor platform. We're actually a conductor. We make our devices out of metals. And because they're made out of metals, obviously the conductivity is much lower than that of silicon. But the challenge becomes, how do you make mechanical structures out of metals? Usually metals, if you take a paperclip is aluminum. If you bend that paperclip back and forth, just think of that as your switch turning on and off. Well, if you do that enough times, that paperclip eventually breaks. You've built up enough dislocations at that point of stress, that your dislocations build up and they form a crack. That crack propagates, and you now have two pieces of metal instead of one. We had to take into account very similar concerns here with our metals, that metals do want to fatigue, they do want to undergo stress relaxation. And so we engineer the compositions of our metals to mitigate those failure properties, such that we have a very robust, a very rigid switch that can last not only tens of cycles or hundreds of cycles, but actually millions and billions of operations.
So the beam itself then is metal, and presumably you have the interconnects printed on the silicon substrate to fan in the signals through the beam to the other side. So what the metal that you use is some proprietary alloy then that you constructed as the right mechanical properties?
Exactly. And again, kind of going back to this concept of we're a conductor, when you think about whether it's a power switch or an RF switch here, signal and signal integrity is really all about getting what you put in as much as consistent as what you put in as you get out on the output end of it. And so one of the best ways to do that is send your signal and your whatever energy you have through a conductor. But also you want to isolate that. You don't want that to leak. And so when we make our devices, we make them on fused silica substrates. And so now you're taking kind of the best of both worlds for both the power and the RF space, about combining metals for your signal path or your conductive path, and then purely insulating, in this case, fused silicon dioxide, on as you're insulating material. And then, to actually, yes, answer your question, we do have a series of proprietary alloys, because most metals, again, will go through these types of deformation properties. And so we've engineered the chemistries of our fabrication techniques to put down very precise alloys that resist both temperature and time-based deformation, to make sure that when our switch operates the first time, and when it operates the billionth or multiple billionth time, that it's doing so with the same performance from the first time all the way through its life.
Wow. So for the electrostatic force to actuate, there's some electrode under the cantilevered beam that you're going to apply the voltage to. So that puts a limit to what's the maximum voltage you can have on the the beam itself where the signal's being carried?
Correct. Just like in electrostatics, the closer your movable element is to this gate electrode, to this pad, the lower the voltage that you need. But there's also a trade-off there. We make a series of devices that are typically between that can withstand maybe between 150 to 300 volts. Well, the closer I put that cantilever, sure, I can have a lower voltage to turn it on and off, but that means I also have a lower voltage in which the device can withstand when it's in the open state. And so we do, you kind of have to play these trade-offs in mechanics of, okay, I can make the device actually operate at 3 volts if we wanted it to, but then you would only have, let's say, a 10 or 20 volt capability to withstand those voltages. We found that really having more than 100 volts for both operational and transient voltages are really key to some of these whether it's test and measurement applications, communication applications, mil-aero applications, and power applications, where the voltages and the need for both signal integrity and power at voltages is critical.
So before we get into the applications, I'd like to understand a little bit of some of the electrical properties of the switch itself. So there's always the DC properties, and like you're alluding to, the higher frequency signal integrity properties. So for DC, so you put your switches in some kind of a package, probably a hermetically sealed package then, or some environmental protection. When you look from pad to pad in the package, what sort of DC resistances do you have in the closed state and isolation voltages in the open state?
Sure. So in the, if you take our chip and you put it in the closed state, we're typically right around, and if you take one of our RF chips, we're typically right around 1 ohm in the closed state. And we're typically, well, let's say at 100 volts, we'll typically have a few picoamps of leakage in the open state. So at that point, we're in the kind of in the gigaohm plus range. So very, call it low on state losses when closed, and then very high isolation and leakages, and even leakages, very high, very little leakage at at even 100 or 200 volts.
Very high isolation. So at least 100 volt isolation between channels or between the input and the output then.
Absolutely. And typically we spec over 150.
Yeah. What do you think is the maximum current you can send through one of your switches?
That's always a good question, because it's like, well, now the question is do you want to blow up the switch or do you want it to actually operate again? Because we all know that we can certainly send current through, but there's always a consequence sometimes if we send too much current. In the safe operating range, typically within our RF switches, we don't engineer those for higher currents, and typically those anywhere from, let's say, half an amp of DC current all the way up to an amp. But we do offer, and we do offer power, we'll call our power relay products that are near completion of their development. And there we have a switch that is closer to 5 milliohms of resistance, 5 milliohms, not 5 ohms. Uh-huh. And that switch can now transmit about 10 amps of current and do so very safely and in good operating conditions without blowing up. Obviously, when you push the limits, you can push the limits. We test a lot of these relays transiently to well over 100 amps of current.
Uh-huh. Wow. So before we get into the higher frequency signal integrity properties, so when you have these power relays, when you have 10 amps going through them, you know, the traditional problem with reed relays is you put a current through it, you open them up, and you get a big arc, and it starts corroding the electrodes there. Are there any special issues in your metallization that when you cut off the 10 amps, that you don't get an arc or it doesn't degrade the surface?
Well, that's a great question. We have really two ways of handling that. There will always be some type of arc when you open and close a contact. What we do is we have supporting circuitry around the switch. And that's really that supporting circuitry that understands the current that's going through the switch, understands the timing that we need to open, understands the timing of our own mechanisms, and it provides the switch, I'll call it a quasi-safe operating window. Now, that window may only be a few microseconds, but it provides a window for this switch to open, I'll call it nearly arc-free. And,
wow.
And nearly arc-free because that's what we want for creating a long life switch and a long life contact. But it operates and enables a 300 volt 10 amp circuit to open nearly arc-free. And then the switch and the metallurgies, the actual microscopic contacts and materials handle the small amount of energy that the circuitry can't dissipate.
And I guess having low inductance in your switch helps a lot too. Then
low
that'll cut
inductance
the voltage
helps.
Down.
Yeah, that you're absolutely right. Low inductance really helps because you need, if you're trying to get this voltage and current away, let's say away from the contacts, you need to move it somewhere momentarily. Having low inductance really helps. Having low capacitance helps, and having low resistance helps. Right, it all enables that movement of energy, that movement of electrons away from the interface. But it but also we also know that, right, if you have that movement and that movement occurs instantaneously, we'll introduce.
It's a pretty large DIDT.
Yeah, whether it's DIDT, DVDT, you are going to get a large spike of either voltage or current. And so it's not, we don't do things instantaneously. We do them very controlled. And we also open our switches very controlled. In one relay, you asked about a read relay earlier. Well, a read relay has one contact. Our relays have hundreds of microscopic contacts. Think of it like a piano, right? Where you can open up, you don't open up every single contact instantaneously. There is actually some control of those, the control of those contacts and control of that opening event. And that's why between that understanding about how our device opens and the circuitry, we can minimize those transients, which would typically destroy if we didn't, we didn't control it.
Yeah, this is one of the things I was so interested in when I saw your booth at DesignCon, is that, you know, such a simple device, a switch, an open and closed switch, has so much really cool technology on the inside that it sounds like you're really taking advantage of in optimizing the performance of just a simple open and closing for DC high current performance.
Absolutely. I kind of like to call this the simplest, hardest project I've ever worked on in my right, it's simplistic in its nature in terms of it's a switch. Simplistic in terms of its operation in that it operates electrostatically, but now to take those principles and to do that efficiently, effectively for millions and billions of times, to do so with the same level of performance at the same voltages, and to do so with high power, to do so with RF. Every application and opportunity brings its own set of challenges. And to make a component simple means it has to handle a multitude of different applications. And that's really where the complexity comes in, is taking a simple device and making it useful in all these other applications.
And now let's talk about the higher frequencies, signal integrity applications. So the high frequency properties are partly related to your switch element, but also related to how you connect to it in the package, so that you have controlled impedance getting to the switch, and you engineer the signal and the return path in that switch element. Do you have some feel for what that ultimate performance is of your switch, given the switch and the package, how high bandwidth or where your 3 dB points are?
Well, everyone always wants something smaller and faster, right? And so, and without any loss of signal integrity, it's right. A lot of this comes down to line length. When you think about it, again, thinking about it from the principle of it's a conductor. So if you wanted to make a transmission line, and make that transmission line have the lowest loss possible, well, you're probably not going to make a 5 meter transmission line. You're probably going to make that transmission line millimeters or centimeters. And so really what we do is we engineer the, we're not so much engineering the switch, we're actually engineering the input to output, really the transmission of that transmission line as it goes through, and the switch is just in between that line. The overall losses of the switch itself are extremely minimal, and it's really more about engineering your transmission line because, again, the building blocks of this are metal and glass. And so, right, you've got your conductor, you've got your insulator, and now it's a matter of good transmission line design. So, yes, we're always looking for higher frequencies. We're always looking to push the limits, and our products today are pushing right now. Our products are we sell a variety of products with different switch configurations, kind of in the 10 to 20 gigahertz range. And from a signal, from a data rate perspective, one of our products, a single pole three throw switch, very easily does 64 gigabits a second. And can do so with PAM4. So you're getting a lot more data through there than just a single channel. But that's not the end, right? Right. This is just the beginning of where we can take this. And so we have developed part of our roadmap is about how to extend our frequencies, our frequency from 20 gigahertz today to 40 and 60 gigahertz, and we have development products in the works right now that are under test and evaluation that are meeting those targets, and meeting those targets with, I think we're somewhere in the range of 40 to 50 gigahertz right now with about 1 dB of insertion loss, which
Wow.
is exciting to see those results come out. But a lot of it has to do with that integration in the package too. So it's not just about the device. It's about making sure that we have the good integrity from the input all the way through the output of our
So you're
package.
starting with a really small switch that's nearly transparent. And it's really about, like you just said, how you integrate it into the package environment to provide that high bandwidth.
Exactly. It's the switch is one element. The switch by itself can absolutely do that. It's the full integration that always has to be tweaked and really understood to maintain that good integrity from the input to the all the way through to the output.
One of the limitations then has to be the about the switch is in the open state, the isolation, you get some capacitive coupling between the beam and the other side. Do you have an idea of what sort of crosstalk or isolation you can get in your switches?
Sure. Some of the and again, obviously that's all frequency dependent, and we typically try to target at the low end of our capability, and maybe I should say at the other end at the high end, the where you get the most crosstalk. We have architectures that are typically in the like the 20 dB of isolation, but that is a matter of really seriousing elements together. So if I want to take that same isolation and take it to 30 or 40 dB at a given frequency, it's a matter of putting just really another switch in series, not a component, not a chip, but actually just another actuator in series with that. And then if you want more isolation, you put another actuator in series. You really all you're doing is you're extending your the length of isolation or extending the length of opens in your circuit.
The ultimate is probably the capacitive coupling between the open end and the other end of the connection. And so the higher frequency, the higher the or the less the isolation. And so you're just adding capacitors in series, getting a smaller equivalent capacitance and higher isolation.
Exactly. And because it's on glass, we don't really worry about the capacitive coupling through the substrate. It's really the just making your air gap capacitors, as you defined here, between your transmission line.
Okay, so given these properties, you get a switch that has really low resistance, and you get the real high bandwidth switches. Where do you see the application for these two kinds of switches?
Yeah, so we, from an application perspective, we're finding really tremendous benefit to our customers, right? To me, it's always about how, okay, you make a technology, but it's about the benefit of how do you take this technology and provide benefit to the customer, to the people using that product. And so we're finding good traction with this in the test and measurement space. We're in DIB boards for testing high-speed digital products, for testing whether it's chips or AI chips that are really pushing the boundary of data and data rate. We're also in just general telecommunications. One of the great properties of this relay is not only its signal and is the ability to have very low loss and the signal integrity that goes through it, but also the ability to do that at appreciable power levels. So it's and not just at milliwatts or microwatts, but at 1 watt, 5 watt, even up to 25 watts of RF power. So we're finding applications in the not only in the test and measurement space, but in the telecommunication space, not just, let's say, in handsets, but really also in the infrastructure, where whether this is in radios and in satellite communication, or in even just backhaul. So this is about a relay. Anytime you want to turn something on and off, whether it's for signal purposes, for power, for communications, and even to the point of switching your lights on and off of AC and DC signal of this is we're finding applications in all those spaces of things that we want to control. It's a
Wow.
switch. It's a very simplistic element.
Yeah, so it's a very simplistic element with a lot of really cool technology on the inside that gives it this wide range of properties for these different applications.
You nailed it right there.
Yeah.
But I
Well,
couldn't say it better myself.
hey, I'm just, parroting back what I learned here in our discussion today. And Chris, hey, thank you so much for your time. We're out of time right now. I really appreciate the time you spent. I learned a lot. Very cool technology. Can't wait to see some more applications of this.
Eric, thank you so much for having me, and all the best to you.
And we will add a URL for your website in the show notes and invite all of our listeners to check out these really cool switches from Menlo Micro.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
And that concludes my interview. My thanks to Chris for joining us, and thank you, our listeners, for tuning in. I hope you check out all of our other podcasts at the Signal Integrity Journal. And that's 30 for this edition.